ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land. In our last week of summer shows, we're revisiting some of the conversations we know you enjoyed most in 2025. One was with John Menadue, veteran political insider, Qantas chair, founder, and lately editor-in-chief of the website Pearls and Irritations. John reflects on what he's learnt about himself, his country and its politics in his long years at the top. Now, I want to make it very clear right from the start, John Menadue is not retiring. He's turned 90 and he's stepping back a little from one or two of his ventures, but he is not retiring. It's the stepping back that gives us our excuse for sitting down with him now to reflect on one or two of the lessons his long life has taught him in business, public service, and lately the media. John Menadue was in there at the start of so much that shapes this country still. The Murdoch press, the Whitlam government, the collapse of White Australia, the Hawke government. Then he set up the think tank, the Centre for Policy Development, launched the online weekly New Matilda, and is proprietor, a rather grand term but deserved, of the online site Pearls and Irritations, from which he is, as I say, stepping back a little. To tell us what he's learned along the way, John Menadue joins us from our Canberra studio. John, welcome to Late Night Live.
Good. Thank you, David. Very glad to be with you.
Now, John, in a life so filled with success, there's a failure there right back at the start that I suspect explains a lot about your career. You stood for Labour in the seat of Hume in the election of 1966 and failed. How?
The feeling in Australia at that time was in favour of the war in Vietnam. Arthur Korber was the leader, and the Labour Party, I think, took a very principled position in opposing that war and Australian involvement in it. And I was candidate on the losing side in 1966. The tide turned in 69 and 72. But I'd gone on to other things by then. But it was a useful lesson for me to get out in the electorate and listen to people. But the main opposition I got as a Labor candidate was from, for example, the railway workshops in Junee. I would have thought that would have been a natural supporting base for me, but that was a hostile community who feared the yellow hordes coming from the North and taking over Australia.
You never stood for election again. You put that aside as a possible career path.
Yes, I have. Other opportunities came along, working for Rupert Murdoch after I left Gough Whitlam. And that was, for me, a quite exciting period. That was what I would call in Rupert's better days. I knew at the Australian newspaper, he was open to ideas, supporting Labor, of course, in the 72 election. So that opened up new opportunities for me. And I found in life that you get to certain stages or certain turning points in your life when suddenly things make sense. That's the vocation for you. For example, I came from White Australia, country towns of South Australia, and I roomed with three Malaysian students. I'd never confronted or thought about race, White Australia. White Australia was a given. And rooming with those three Malaysian students back in the mid-50s.
This was at university?
In the university, yes, University College. It just confronted my ignorance. And I guess from that time on, I've been very concerned about race issues, relations with our own region, of course, including now China. So that was a turning point that it's suddenly you say, that's right for me. That's what I'll do. It's like turning on a switch. The enthusiasm and energy come. And in my life, I think I've had many of those sorts of occasions. I think everyone does.
Yep.
Suddenly, this makes sense for me.
Let me throw some footnotes in. So you had been, before standing in the seat of Hume, Gough Whitlam's private secretary. So Gough was at that stage, well, he was not even leader of the opposition at that stage, was he?
He was a contender,
the deputy. And then you stood, lost, and then you moved to Murdoch. In those days, you were both in your 30s, you and Rupert Murdoch, both in your 30s, and he set about transforming newspapers in Australia. What were his ambitions? What did he achieve in those years?
I think the Australian at that stage, establishing that, was a great achievement. We'd had all those parochial state newspapers. I think the Australian now has become a disgrace. But it was, I think, very important in those early days. I found Rupert very open to ideas. I discussed things with him. I had a very close personal association with him. When I went to London on a visit, he was at a cottage up in the Cotswolds. He cooked my breakfast and drove me to church. So I was very close to him, and it was quite exciting what Rupert was doing. I remember once he said to me that if you're going to be successful in the media, you need to, particularly in the English-speaking world, you need to get into those three major markets. News is important, but also sport, entertainment. And I think the importance of entertainment has been a key factor in the way he's developed his media. But he always remained extremely interested in politics. When I was with him, I remember he discussed the possibility he might run as a candidate for Parliament, presumably based on his home at Cavan, just outside Canberra.
For what party?
He didn't say, but at that stage he was very close to Jack McEwen, the leader of the National Party. It was sheer speculation on Rupert's part. He would never have done it, I'm sure. And if he had tried, he'd be very frustrated after the first 6 months. But he was conveying to me in that sort of unlikely way that he was very keen on politics, and he was, and still is. I think that's something like an aphrodisiac for Rupert. He's extremely interested in politics, and events since then, when I've spoken to him about the dismissal and other issues, that interest in politics has always been there. But clearly he's become much more conservative.
What happened to him? I mean, in 1972, he was backing Labor. The Australian newspaper, The Australian, transformed newspapers in Australia, changed the age of the Sydney Morning Herald profoundly. They had to keep up with this modern, intelligent national broadsheet. You say he was close to McEwen, the leader of the National Party, the Country Party, but he was also very close to many figures in Labor. What happened to him? Why did he become, by 1975, so profoundly hostile to Labor?
So it was halfway there in 1974, the election which Whitlam won, and Rupert then went down the middle. He had one editorial supporting Labor and another editorial giving the case for the Liberal Party. By 75, I think he was very concerned about the way the Whitlam government was performing, the economy. He was clearly influenced by the business community, the things he was hearing from them. And he decided, I think, at that stage that Gough was no longer a winner and that the tide was turning. The Liberal Party, with Malcolm Fraser or Snedden at the time, was an indication of what was going to happen in the future. So he changed. I think also when he went to England and then to the United States, he became very much influenced by Maggie Thatcher and then Ronald Reagan and the neoliberal people who had a very right-wing view of the role of the economy, of the role of business and the role of minimal role of government. I think they were big influences. I think also, maybe it's a personal comment, that I think a person that stabilised Rupert in those early stages was his wife, Anna Murdoch. And they divorced. And I think that Rupert lost a stabilising influence in his life. So the combination of all those factors. And Rupert was way out now on the extreme of the right and running an organisation which is doing enormous damage.
Can you believe it is now 50 years since that day in November 1975 when you were head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet for Gough Whitlam, when you discovered that your boss had been sacked and that you had, courtesy of the Governor-General, a new boss? And I can never forget one of the details of that day, that at a certain point you had a phone call from Fraser's office to remind you that you were the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and he wanted to see you. And you, is this correct, you left Gough's presence and went to this new man?
Yes, that's right. After I got word of the dismissal from David Smith, the official secretary for the Governor General, telling me that the Whitlam government had been dismissed, I rang Fred Wheeler, Secretary of Trade, Alan Cooley, the chairman of the Public Service Board, and then I got a message from through Gough's driver that Gough wanted to see me at the lodge. When I got there, he was eating a steak, seemed to be enjoying it. But the first thing he said to me, "Comrade, that bastard Kerr has done a game on me," referring to the sacking of the by Governor Game of the Lang government in New South Wales back in the 30s. There was a discussion with Gough as to what might happen. Colleagues came. And then my secretary, Elaine Miller, rang me after I'd been with Gough, I suppose, about 20, 25 minutes. And she said, "The Prime Minister, Mr. Fraser, wants to see you." So I told her, "Tell him you can't find me." Which,
yes.
which was a standard way. I was trying to get my head around what was happening. And about 10 minutes later, she rang again and said, "John, this is a quote from Malcolm Fraser. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, wants to see you urgently." So I decided that I should attend. I was still trying to get my head around all that. And off I went to Parliament House. Malcolm Fraser was in his office on the opposition side with all his colleagues. It was a hubbub of noise and activity. So we met, shook hands, and slowly I was getting to understand my role, that I was serving, not the person, but I was serving the Prime Minister, and took action accordingly. I didn't stay with him for very long. I went back to the department and I was preparing material for the swearing in of the ministry, of the Fraser ministry, next morning. And then I had another meeting with Malcolm Fraser late that day, had a drink with him at the Canberra Club at the end of the day. I was invited to have dinner with him at the Canberra Club, but I decided that I'd had enough for the day and I limped home for consolation with my family.
John,
it was a day I didn't expect.
No, it was the day a nation didn't expect. Well, I'm a 75 nutter. I mean, I was a very, very young journalist at the Bulletin, and the editor's secretary came around to my cubicle and said, the Governor-General, she was Canadian, wonderful woman, the Governor-General sacked the Prime Minister. And I said, no, look, it doesn't work like that. But she insisted, and she was right. Do you think conservative Australia, its politicians in particular, learnt a lesson from the sacking? Do you think we can now say they would never try that again?
No, I can't say they wouldn't try it again. I think Gough performed a public function in the criticism he made of Kerr afterwards. And I think any future Governor General that tried that step, tried to do that again, would suffer the same ignominy as Kerr suffered. But there's no change in the Constitution. I think politicians have learnt something, but there was and still is, I think, a born-to-rule view by conservative interests in politics and in business that a Labor government is an aberration. Bob Hawke did something, I think, to ameliorate that. But there is still, I think, a view that somehow a Labor government is an interloper. Things have improved in that regard, but they're still there. I think the thing that I personally learned from the dismissal is that the great and the good cannot be trusted. I grew up believing that people like Governors General, Chief Justices of the High Court and the Justice, the Queen, the Palace, were all trustworthy people. I concluded after that I'd been naive and they were not trustworthy, particularly the Governor General. And other experiences I've had in dealing with a Chief Justice has confirmed that view, that I need to be more careful in whom I trust. And that was the great learning experience for me. I think out of it, I became more radical. And at my age, well, I guess one's supposed to become more conservative, I think as the years have passed, I've become much more radical in my political views and the need for fundamental reform in so many parts and institutions in Australia.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, and we are listening to my conversation with John Menadue about his life and times. John, if Fraser had come to power in the ordinary way by winning an election, would he be remembered very differently today?
I think he would have been. I think Malcolm Fraser turned out, from my experience, to be a surprisingly good Prime Minister. That was not the way many people in the Liberal Party and Conservative ranks viewed him. I think that he was very conscious that he had divided Australia in a very fundamental sort of way. So that he was more accommodating to the trade union movement, particularly to Hawke and others, that he had to mend fences. And so that he was very cautious on reform, on change, as Conservatives would have liked him to have been. But from my experience on issues such as race, white Australia, refugee programs, his attitudes towards the American, there was a lot to commend Malcolm Fraser that I didn't expect. One of the, I think, most meaningful jobs that I had in public life was Secretary of the Immigration Department. When I was finishing my, coming to the end of my term in Japan, Malcolm visited and he said, John, when you come back to Australia, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to come back and help bury Australia, bury white Australia. And he said, you're on. And I came back and I was heading the Immigration Department within about 3 months. And the Indochina refugee program, which with Family Union and other follow through, we took about 250,000 Indochinese. That was a memorable and decisive change. Gough Whitlam and the Labor government had, through their Racial Discrimination Act, made racism illegal, particularly affecting, well, many areas, but in this case, migration. So technically, that ended white Australia, but it was never put to the test because there was very little migration to Australia during the period of the Whitlam government. But Malcolm Fraser put it to the test, and he succeeded. And I think in working with he and with Ian McPhee at the time, I found that very meaningful, that we could, because I'd had a background of concern about racism and white Australia, and I found Malcolm and Ian McPhee extraordinarily good to work with, very receptive in ways that I didn't expect. One thing, for example, Malcolm was very cautious about the Americans. And after I'd left, one thing that Malcolm insisted that anyone with overflight or basing in Australia, aircraft, they could not carry nuclear weapons. And that was the Americans. And Malcolm made it very clear that if they were operating over Australia or from Australia, they would never be able to carry nuclear weapons without his government's approval. Frankly, that was consistent with Malcolm. He very much stood for Australian sovereignty, and I wish the present government would do the same.
John, to what extent do you think Malcolm Fraser's views on race, which were so like your own, but I wonder to what extent they were shaped by the fact that he had a Jewish grandfather?
I think it was a factor. He never spoke about it, but his grandfather on the male side was Schultz, a German Jew. And of course, the Jewish line usually comes through the feminine, the female side. I think that was a factor. I never heard him talk about it. And I think with the farmers and supporters in Western Victoria, he decided politically it wasn't a goer. I think also when he went to Oxford, Malcolm was a pretty angular, awkward sort of bloke. And I don't think that the English upper-class boys at Oxford had much sympathy and empathy with an angular, difficult fellow like Malcolm Fraser. And I know that the people that he endeared himself to and reverse reciprocated were black students from Africa. So I think he had that soft spot there from that experience, his background, and it showed through practically throughout his life in his attitudes to race. He was very good on that issue, land rights and so on.
And apartheid, faced down his party over apartheid.
That's right, yes. And Maggie Thatcher over southern Rhodesia and Mugabe.
But John, to what extent do you see Australian politics now still distorted by race?
Yes, it is. I think we've made a lot of progress, but our performance on our Indigenous people, the surprising and regrettable loss of the Voice referendum, indicates that we've still got a long way to go. The Albanese government has very much gone low-key, almost underground on Indigenous matters, overcoming the gap. But that's unfinished business in Australia. And you eloquently describe it in your book, Killing for Country. And it's still happening. And that influence is still with us. And we're supporting the government of Israel, which is killing for country as well. But I think we have a long way still to go domestically on the way that we manage our relations with the Indigenous people of this country. I remember some years ago I was heading an inquiry for the South Australian government on health issues, and I had a meeting with some Aboriginal women, and at the end of my presentation, a very senior and well-known auntie, as they were called, spoke to me, and she said, "Mr. Menendez, thank you very much for what you're doing about health amongst my people." But she said, "Whenever I speak to them, about their health, they say to me, "Auntie, with our prospects in life, what's the point of being healthy?" And it floored me, and it still does. That lack of esteem, confidence about their future, so that we need to address Aboriginal and Indigenous disadvantage on a whole range of issues. But what we have destroyed more than anything else is their confidence and self-esteem and the future that they might have for themselves and the rest of the Australians.
John, do you think it is race in part that makes Australians seem unconfident or reluctant to engage with the countries around it, to yes. engage with our region?
That's one factor, undoubtedly. I think the abolition of white Australia was a big help to us. But the treatment of our Indigenous people and our hypocrisy of talking about other countries about human rights, whether they be in Tibet or Xinjiang or China or wherever, is understood that our hypocrisy doesn't work in our region. But I think the other important reason is that our media and our politicians are still in a sort of London-Washington cul-de-sac. They think and act as if we're little Americans in more recent days. And that's right across Australia, the Americanization of Australia in our media, in our politics, in our business, is evident everywhere. And that, the way that we've been framed in our attitudes, or our attitudes framed by that historic legacy, means that we really shut out and are very ignorant of our own region. And the media, of course, is probably the worst of all in that regard, that we are well informed about Donald Trump and America, but very little about Indonesia, Malaysia, China. So it's not just Indigenous issues that have kept us blinded to our own region. It's the way we've clung like limpets to the Anglosphere, first of London and later of Washington.
But I wonder to what extent you think that money has a role here, and I mean the collapse of advertising revenue for the press. There are fewer foreign correspondents in Indonesia, in India. Well, China won't let us in, of course. And news flows almost free of charge from London and America.
Yes, it is. It's the one organisation that could be doing it much better, of course, is the ABC. With low government funding is a difficulty. But in terms of our own interest, I'm not sure what the staffing of the ABC is in London. Do we really need an office in London anymore? Surely an office in Jakarta, a large office in Jakarta, would be more important than an office in London. John Lyons was giving us a very good report, reports from Israel and the genocide there. But now his request, he's whipped off to Washington. I think that's the story of so much of corporate life in Australia, that we focus on the United States. And that Americanization is everywhere. It's in our films, it's in our media, it's our politicians, it's in most of our major companies are owned by Americans. They frame public life in Australia almost completely. And it's very hard for politicians and others to put their hands up and say, which they should, of course, we want to develop better relations with our own region. We are terribly ignorant of our relations with our region. That's where our future is. It's not with Washington or London.
But we do have to report Washington superbly, do we not? Isn't that a fundamental obligation of the press?
It is, but what is reported so often is domestic trivia out of America, as if we're a state of the United States. Certainly what Trump and America does in terms of our own region and our own interests – is very important to us. But I think the so much of it is caught up with domestic trivia about shootings in schools in America, floods in America, some odd behaviour in American domestic life. And our media is filled with it all the time. And the ABC has a program called, what I think, Planet America. Why the hell are we doing that? I just don't know.
But, John, that's analysis of United States politics. I mean, I don't know whether you watch it, but that's what it is.
I pick up, when I do watch it, I pick up a lot of domestic issues in the United States.
Yes. John, what happened to that movement for Australians to learn the languages of our region? There was a time when everybody was learning Bahasa, everybody was learning Japanese, people were learning Mandarin, but that seems to have gone. What happened to that?
I think the name that I refer to is John Howard.
Explain.
The ex-Prime Minister, very conservative, and he, after the reform periods of the Hawke-Keating government and previously the Whitlam government, he's told Australians we need to be relaxed, comfortable again. And the progress that had been made, the Garneau report on the Northeast Asian ascendancy, interest in Asian languages, in which we were in the Department of Immigration, we were pursuing, the universities were responding. But I think John Howard was a major political influence in turning a lot of that down and sometimes turning it off. And we've had a collapse, as you say, of language learning across the universities. And it's going to be very hard to turn it back on. We'll keep trying, though, but we've lost a lot of territory and a lot of time.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to John Menadue, who, I suppose in shorthand these days, we say is the proprietor of the online site Pearls and Irritations. John, going back to your time as a bureaucrat, you were a bureaucrat as secretary to a number of departments over a number of years. How does somebody with your experience look at a scandal like RoboDebt? Could it have happened in your time?
One has to be careful about talking about the golden days of the past, but I don't think it would have. I think over the years, through recruitment, appointments, and I guess I was one of the first of jobs for the boys, but I think there was an ethic there in the public service of responsibility, and senior public servants would have spoken up and warned the government that what they were doing was illegal. I think a lot of the problems stem from back in the John Dawkins days, changes in the public service, contracts. I think the previous arrangements were probably too rigid in terms of the ability to respond to a new government, which is what certainly Gough Whitlam felt.
Because you were appointed for, well, almost for life, were you not?
I was appointed for life. It didn't work out quite that way.
You chose another life. But
Yeah, that's right. That was very largely of my choosing. And salary didn't matter. It was the pleasure and the meaning you get out of doing what I thought was a worthwhile job.
But now secretaries are appointed for a term. Are you saying that has changed the relations between governments and bureaucracy?
I think it has. And the core department, the Public Service Commission, I think don't have the influence that they used to have. There are some very good people still in the public service in Australia. They've been undermined a lot, of course, by doling out so much work to consulting companies, the big four accounting firms. But there's still a lot of good sense and good people in the service. And I think if they're given their head, they'll continue to give good advice to the government. But Robodebt was clearly an enormous mistake. And a lot of that could be pinned, I think, on Scott Morrison, who said, well, you know, policies for the government, so you're just there to implement. And I think some of them took that to mean that government could do illegal things and we wouldn't speak up.
John, at some point, and why, I ask, you decided that you would concentrate on, I suppose, forming public opinion, setting up a think tank, setting up a media presence. Why did you do it? What were your hopes? And do you even now retain a fundamental faith in persuasion?
Yes, I do. The term of Graham Greene, the only unforgivable sin is despair. And there's a lot of ways in which we could despair today. But I hope I've kept the passion, if you like, and the determination to correct and reform what I see. I'm a member of the Catholic Church. I'm a member of the ALP. I'm concerned about both of them. I live on the fringe of both. I don't go near the centres of power. And I'm hoping that persuasion, energy, that still it is possible to reform. And the present government is showing some signs, but not many at the present time. But the media, to me, has been very disappointing, the legacy media as I describe it. And I guess that while I've got some years left, I'll continue to pursue media opportunities to ensure that we can put out articles and writers, both from Australia and overseas, that can bring to Australian people possibilities for the future that we should keep in mind and not get caught up in the backwash of the United States, the contempt and fear of China, the problems of climate change, and probably which is the biggest confronting issue which we have in this world at the present time. So I remain optimistic. I'm not going to despair. I'm probably a bit like Dylan Thomas, you know, I could keep raging till raging about the dying of the light, but hopefully I can age gracefully as well and give way and encouragement to people who will take my place.
If I've got this right, it seems to me that one of your real drivers is that we should be paying more attention to ourselves. Is that correct? Is that what you see?
We are, I think, pretty selfish. And that's a feature, I think, of everyone. I remember, I thought it was some years ago, Muhammad Ali, in his heyday, was speaking at Oxford, and that debating society they have. And he was asked by someone in the audience, give us a poem. And he said, we. And he sat down. I think that's not a bad poem and a bit of advice, I think, for me and for everyone, that we have our individual interests, which we need to pursue, but we are also part of a wider community that we have to serve gracefully if we possibly can.
Yes, I was being a bit clumsy, John. What I really meant was that Australians need to pay more attention to themselves as Australians rather than living in what you call the backwash of the United States. That we don't kind of respect our own problems and challenges enough.
I'm sure that's right. What I think Paul Keating calls these Austro-Americans that dominate so much of our media and think tanks and business, that they see themselves as pale Americans in Australia. And I think that that's very clear. The media is the cul-de-sac, of course, where all that occurs. They're thinking about somewhere else and not Australia. And the successive Australian governments increasingly look to America. We've allowed bases in this country, which in previous days Whitlam and Fraser would never have allowed. Our sovereignty has been clearly prejudiced in recent years. And it really started, surprisingly enough, from the Gillard government, at least in the defence area. Until then, we had developed a fairly self-sufficient defence capability in Australia. That followed the Guam document, Nixon doctrine after the end of the Vietnam War, where the Americans said, well, we can't be involved in every skirmish in our region. It's short of, say, major attack. Countries of the region would have to look after their own defence interests. And that's what we did for 35 years. But the Gillard government, so keen to get Obama to visit Australia in 2010, as part of the sweetener for an Obama visit, agreed with the help of Kim Beazley that Australia would allow the rotation of American Marines through Darwin. And from that has followed, under Conservative governments and Labor governments, the entrenched defence position of the United States in Australia. I remember Gough Whitlam saying to me, comrade, he said, the only time that we should allow foreign bases in this country is in an emergency or under the United Nations request. But we have these string of bases and they're continuing to develop at Tyndall, one down the West Australian coast for nuclear-powered submarines, and Tyndall, hoping for bases also down the east coast. Cocos Keeling is likely to be one in the future. The airport is being upgraded for American purposes. So we have really shed so much of our sovereignty. I think Richard Miles, the defence minister, has a love affair with the United States. And Anthony Albanese has shown some indications that he's unhappy. He hasn't yet scrapped AUKUS, but he's indicated that in the event of an attack on or a war between America over and China over Taiwan, we wouldn't commit ourselves to the future. But what we should be saying is that we should be saying now publicly and privately that in no circumstances will we ever be involved supporting the Americans in a war over Taiwan. So there's some things that Albanese has been doing, which I think are indications. I hope that he can strengthen that position, but most importantly of all, scrap AUKUS as fast as he can.
Let's get to AUKUS in a second. I was just wanting to ask whether you see the behaviour of Trump, particularly in relation to Ukraine and relation to Israel, gives Australia an opportunity to get out of lockstep with the United States in a way that we haven't had for a long time.
I'm sure that's the case. I think we can be very critical of sort of the crazy behaviour of the Trump administration, but their behaviour, I think, is a warning sign to Australia. And to some extent, Trump is just a symptom of the American malady, there is this opportunity carefully to extricate ourselves from the overzealous commitment which we have to the United States. And there's no doubt that Australians are getting increasingly sceptical about Trump. I saw a figure the other day that about two-thirds of Australians have less confidence now than they had previously. Said about two-thirds of Australians less confidence in America under Trump than they have before. The signs are that I think Australians are coming to terms with the fact that we need to change our attitudes towards the United States. And Trump, I think, will help in doing that. One strange feature also is that clearly Trump is being derided for suggesting that he might be interested in a Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, yes.
And derision in that, I can understand. But if that's what Trump would like, and if he could produce peace with justice in Ukraine and in Gaza, I'd swallow my pride and let Trump have a Nobel Peace Prize. If that's the incentive for him, why
go
not?
For it.
It would be a great service to many people. But the Trump administration, I think, many, many downsides, but there are possibilities that we need to pursue.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, and we are listening to my conversation with John Menadue last year when, alas, the Peace Prize eluded poor Donald. John, as a media proprietor these days, can you please explain why you've called your website Pearls and Irritations? Explain the name, sir.
It stems from my days in Japan of the artificial pearling industry, that you put a pearl, a grain of sand or some outside element into the shell, and to protect itself, it produces a pearl. And that's what it is, pearls and irritations. My late wife used to say that she was the pearl and I was the irritation. But
yes.
I think it's not a bad name, but it's a bit of a mouthful. Maybe we need to shorten it.
It's a great name. As a media man these days, how do you think the Australian media has gone reporting the biggest story in the world, Gaza?
It's a disgrace. Across the board, where does one start? Clearly, the major media have been barrackers for Israel and the support by the United States. Words like genocide, occupation, ethnic cleansing are either avoided or they are censored from discussion.
Still?
As far as I can see, I think the ABC says that they'll use the word genocide if someone else uses that word, but they won't use it themselves. The media believe and want us to believe that the current genocide started on October 7 with the Hamas attack in Israel.
That's not true of all the media, though, John. Some, yes.
I find it hard to distinguish any that have stood out, have really described. John Lyons did for the ABC, but others who go back and give us the history, going back decades, perhaps almost 100 years, how Israel has progressively occupied, taken over, murdered, displaced people on a large scale, and that October 7 was just another sort of like the pressure cooker blowing up, that they had to, that there was a response from decades of oppression, and it didn't all start on October 7. I think the Netanyahu government has wanted us to believe it all started on October 7. All started with Hamas. It didn't. From the beginning, Netanyahu was not about contesting or about Hamas. It was about ethnic cleansing. And we're seeing now, hopefully in the final stages, dreadfully, of what's happening, that Netanyahu himself and his government are making it very clear that their objective all along was to ethnic cleanse and get Palestinians out of Gaza.
John, as a former diplomat and as a man of government for so many years, what do you think of the Prime Minister of Israel calling the Prime Minister of Australia a weak man?
I think it's quite inappropriate for Benjamin Netanyahu to be criticising our Prime Minister, but given that Netanyahu is an indicted domestic criminal for fraud and embezzlement, and also an internationally indicted war criminal, a criminal for war crimes and crimes against humanity. I think the Australian Prime Minister is quite proper in calling for the recognition of Palestine and also for visa exclusion of some right-wing colleague of Netanyahu's. So I think that we should discount Netanyahu, although I do wish that Prime Minister Albanese had been much stronger over the last 18 months in calling out the genocide that Israel has been inflicting on the Palestinian people.
John, a last question. Do you keep souvenirs of your career? If you do, what's the souvenir that you most value?
I guess two things. I think the first is, as I mentioned earlier, working for Malcolm Fraser and Ian McPhee on helping to end white Australia. I think I take considerable pride in that, although there's been a bit of slippage since then. The second is, I guess, Pearls and Irritations, an opportunity. The days may, how many days I have ahead, and that remains to be seen, but I'm pleased with what we've done. We need to expand by engaging more in social media. But I'm quite pleased with what I've done. I'll probably keep raging at the dying of the light like Dylan Thomas, but I hope I can also age gracefully and encourage people around me to step up and not be concerned that people may no longer listen to me. I'm quite pleased, and I can do a few more things, God willing.
John, thank you for very elegant raging, very elegant raging. I have been speaking to John Menadue, who in his career has worked with Gough Whitlam, with Malcolm Fraser, as ambassador to Japan. He has worked for so many of the people who have shaped this country, including, for a time, back then, with Rupert Murdoch. John, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And that's the show. On our next, the fresh secrets of ancient Pompeii revealed since a young German took charge at the archaeological site, and the adventures in Australia of 1930s crime writer and big game fisherman Zane Grey.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.